Welcome to Nightlife, the first hour.
Budget 2020.
Our plan will grow the economy. Our plan will create jobs. Our plan will guarantee the essential services that Australians rely on. And we will do this without increasing taxes.
Yeah.
Our plan is guided by our values. Our circumstances may have changed, but our values endure.
Yes, here we are. Who would have thought our Treasurer, Josh Frydenberg, would be handing down a budget in October, not May? It's been described as the most important budget in our living memory, at least. The coronavirus pandemic, of course, has decimated the economy. Australia is facing our first recession in almost 30 years, so long ago that many of us probably don't remember. In August this year, the Australian Bureau of Statistics reported that more than 1 million Australians were unemployed, the official jobless measure breaking through the seven-figure mark for the first time on record. And in May last year, after more than a decade of deficits, the budget produced a surplus of $7.1 billion. 18 months later, gone is the government's pre-virus pledge to get the budget back to surplus and pay off the nation's debt within a decade. All that talk out the door with the pandemic broom. The 2020 plan is a little different.
We have a plan to rebuild our economy and create more jobs. Our JobMaker hiring credit will support nearly 500,000 young Australians into work. Our record investment in skills and training will strengthen Australia's workforce. Our manufacturing plan will support the recovery and build our sovereign capability. Tax incentives will unleash a wave of investment across the country. And tax cuts will put more money into the pockets of 11 million hardworking Australians and their families. And we are building the infrastructure we need for the future.
Well, the government's announced cash welfare handouts, tax cuts, huge investments in manufacturing and infrastructure, all designed to kickstart our economy. Well, joining us tonight to pull apart the government's financial plans for the country, the Nightlife Specialist Budget Team, Cassandra Goldie, the CEO of the Australian Council of Social Service. Cassandra, good evening to you and welcome
evening,
to the studio.
Yes, good evening.
Pleasure to have you with us too. Also joining us, the Research Director at the Centre for Independent Studies, Simon Cowan. Simon, great to have you with us as well. Welcome to Nightlife.
Great to be back.
Yes, well, terrific to have you with us as well. And also joining us, the editor at The Conversation and presenter of ABC's RN's The Economist, of course, Peter Martin. And
g'day.
A voice well known to Nightlife audiences. G'day, Peter.
G'day.
Welcome to you. Let's start with a quick once around before we get into the detail. Has the government, in short, done enough in light of the massive shock to the economy that the pandemic has wrought? Cassandra Goldie.
Well, the short answer is no, in our view. I mean, we've got a budget that has still left millions of people most at risk on lowest incomes or without any income. They've been stranded tonight. There's nothing there for them. We've got a glimmer of hope in terms of some wage subsidies, and we'll probably come back to discuss that further in terms of young people. But beyond that, in terms of the job creation, everybody was saying, well, this is all about jobs. And Peter Martin did an excellent piece in The Conversation last week where he interviewed a whole lot of economists, and they all said, well, what are the top things that you would all do to create jobs with confidence quickly? And you would have done a big investment in social housing, not there, and a big permanent appropriate increase to JobSeeker, putting dollars into the hands of people on low incomes because they need it, and also we know they will spend it. The budget instead relies really heavily, of course, on these tax cuts. I don't want to mince words here. This was wrong to do. It didn't give the money to the people who really needed it, and nor do we have confidence that many of the dollars going into tax cuts will actually be spent. There's speculation tonight. Will they be spent? Well, we knew if we gave it to people on low incomes, it would be. And the other part of it is this heavy reliance, again, on the private sector investing, you know, bundles, billions there in and sort of tax concessions for that purpose. But you've got to have demand in the economy. And we wanted to see a government-led investment at this stage so that we could know that we were going to create jobs as quickly as possible all over the country. So we don't think the design of this was right, given the situation we're in right now.
All right, Simon Cowan, and I mean, Cassandra's right, isn't it? The budget does rely pretty heavily on incentives for private business to get moving, spend money and employ people. Do you think the government's done enough?
Well, the honest answer, and I don't think anyone can give any other answer, then we honestly have no idea. If you look at the assumptions that underpin the government's forecasts here, and the forecasts look better than perhaps we might have expected, but those assumptions are simply impossible for us to assess. Whether or not the borders will be open by the end of the year, whether or not outbreaks of coronavirus will be localised, whether a vaccine will be available in the second half of next year. These are all assumptions which, you know, lick your finger, stick it in the air. That's the closest you'll get to knowing whether that's true or not. And so much of what's here is completely dependent on that. What is clear from these reforms, if we can call them, or at least the measures the government has introduced, they don't actually believe they need to do that much more on the demand side. A lot of what they are focused on here is attempting to generate short-term supply gains from business. So, you know, we see the incentives to try and move investment forward. We see some of these hiring incentives. These are not so much aimed at stimulus in as much as they seem to be aimed at getting the private sector moving again. The government is anticipating that demand will bounce back both in Australia and globally once some of the lockdown measures are ended, and so they're focused a lot more on short-term supply side initiatives. It is genuinely impossible to know whether that's enough, or even whether, you know, what they've done is the best use of this money.
Okay, all right, Peter. They have put their money on red or black. I mean, they've put their money on an approach here, haven't they? I mean, they haven't had a bet each way. they've said, well, look, you know, we're essentially going to make it as attractive as possible for private business to get moving. Have they? Do you think it's enough?
Yeah, they're leading a horse to water, which is sort of half the job done, right? But only half. The words they use, each budget, thanks to the Charter of Budget Honesty, has to set out a budget strategy, which is a little bit of a disturbing thought, Philip, because it implies that budgets wouldn't have a strategy were they not required to do that. And the strategy this time, which is different from previous strategies, they are all about attaining a surplus on balance over time, or don't have that. They've replaced it with this strategy. And its opening words are, and they're bizarre, the strategy is to drive sustainable private sector-led growth.
Mm.
Now, just think about that. So the strategy is for the government to drive sustainable private sector-led growth. But you can sort of get at what they're, you know, notwithstanding the oddness of the concept, the idea is to, and they're spending twice as much money on business as they are on consumer tax cuts, spending $17 billion on consumer tax cuts, twice that on measures for business, a lot of which enable almost every business in the country to spend whatever it wants on equipment of any kind, almost any kind, and sort of have it written off for tax purposes immediately. They're spending a lot of money leading that horse, the horse of business, to water in the hope that the horse drinks. Now, there are reasons to think that the horse won't drink. In fact, we know that even with this, they're expecting private non-mining investment to fall 14% this financial year. Heaven knows what they think would happen without their investment incentive, and then to increase back by only half that, 7%. But businesses, at the same time as they're doing this, business is losing a really important support, which is JobKeeper, that ends on April Fool's Day, right? It ends at the end of March. That's at the moment, according to the budget, supporting the wages of 3.5 million people. Now, the measures they're giving to business, obviously many businesses will fold if they're in the tourism industry so on, because they won't be able to pay the wages themselves. But they're hoping that these incentives will be enough to make up for that. I think it's certainly the Treasurer mentioned hope. I think hope is a big part of it.
Okay, there's some other big hopeful things, aren't there? I mean, there is a serious amount of wishful thinking underpinning the whole project of the budget, isn't there? And Simon, you raised it.
My point about it before was that actually we didn't have to rely on hope in this budget. We could have done things where we knew we would be creating jobs, and care services would have been an obvious area.
Let's get to that in a second. But the biggest piece of wishful thinking is the one that Simon raised, and that is that the government is basically predicating all of this on the fact that borders will be open, there will be a vaccine developed, and Australians will all be vaccinated pretty much by the end of next year. None of that is actually in the offing, is it, Cassandra? I mean,
but what we've got, we do know that we've got increased levels of family and domestic violence. We do know that we've got acute needs in terms of mental health services. We do know we've got a crisis in aged care. We do know that we've got people who are needing a whole range of care and support services in the community because, as you say, we are not out of the woods in any shape or form yet.
No.
And all of those would have dollar for dollar created more jobs than this so-called private sector-led, you know, relying heavily on, will, you know, the supply side, question mark. Mm. And so, again, you know, we're flummoxed, you know, by why in the face of what we've seen over this 12 months of where the big acute gaps were in what the country needs, that we couldn't deliver on a highly feminised workforce like the caring sector, where we've had seen a lot of job losses for, of course, women. And many of those jobs are low and modest income jobs. And again, we know people on low and modest incomes spend because they have to.
Simon, I know the government doesn't know, or maybe they know things that we don't know and are not telling us. But we don't know that we've got that there's going to be a vaccine that works. And if we get a vaccine that does work, we don't know how it's going to work or whether it'll work for very long or whether it'll work for everybody. Now, I know the government can't know these things in advance, but it's a pretty big assumption, isn't it,
that they're making? It absolutely is. It absolutely is. And we can see in some of the sensitivity analysis that you know, some of these forecasts are very dependent on some of those particular assumptions around, you know, the GDP figures are very dependent on the effectiveness of a vaccine. To be fair to the government, and I try not to be fair to most governments most of the time, but to be fair to the government, they do have to forecast some of these things. And if this is the best estimate of Treasury, if this is the best estimate of the experts in this area, then they do have to build that into the budget. The challenge that we have is if those assumptions prove to be incorrect, then even the gruesome figures that are in this budget may quickly go even further south. So there's got to be some flexibility in the government's approach, and perhaps that's one of the reasons why they haven't particularly announced what their plans are for job seeker payments beyond this year. The Treasurer, and when he was talking to Lee Sales tonight, made it clear that they're going to assess that as the end of the year approaches. It's not exactly a commitment to put it back to the old level.
Can we just talk about that for a second? Cassandra, can I just put that to you? Oh, Peter, I'll come back to you in a second. But this is a big issue, this issue of job seeker and job keeper. Now, we've been talking job seeker. Well, let's call it Newstart, which is what it used to be called. There's been a debate going on, ever since time began, it seems, about increasing Newstart. No one, even business, thinks it's enough. Both the government and the opposition have resisted the idea of raising it. This was an opportunity in many people's eyes to do that because
it was an obligation.
Temporarily did increase it. Yeah. Now they're saying, well, that's it. You had it for a bit, but it's over pretty much by the end of the year.
Well, look, it's Anti-Poverty Week next week. What we saw with the cut to the job seeker payment a couple of weeks ago is a whole lot of people, about 300,000, we estimate, you know, dropped back down below the sort of estimated poverty line, and everybody goes, okay, there's no way we could go back to $40 a day. But if you're a person on job seeker tonight, that is what's in the budget. That you will be going back to $40 a day at the end of business saying, oh, all our Christmases have come at once, we've got all these fabulous tax breaks associated with business investment, you know, that's fine, but again, that's a question mark you know, what will happen, whereas we knew that this was an urgent need. I, you know, thank all of the people across the various sectors who have strongly stood up and said this must be fixed. Again, we had the Retailers Association saying that tonight. All of the, you know, who disagrees with it? And as Peter highlighted in his analysis amongst all the economists, they're all backing it. Dollar for dollar, right? You know, 145,000 jobs is what Deloitte was estimating would be at stake if we cut back from what the government did. Whereas on those tax cuts, I want to come back to it for just a moment, for the dollars being spent on those tax cuts, each job, they estimate they're going to create about 50,000 jobs. It's going to cost $500,000 to create one job out of those tax cuts. Peter, could have done a lot better.
Peter, can we just go to you? Because this JobKeeper, in a sense, is being ticked along with another program called JobMaker, which is a job subsidy program.
Now, I are they going to think of other names,
I know,
Phil?
I know. Well, I'm just
We should have a drinking game to think of all of the possibilities.
I'm just using the government's terms here, but
JobMaker,
this debate about Newstart and JobSeeker has been with us now for years. Almost no one seems to think that the level is right. The government seems to have squibbed this decision, which was an obvious time to make a decision about it. Now, why have they done that?
Well, I'm not surprised. The reason I'm not surprised is because they said before the budget very clearly that there wasn't going to be anything in the budget, but they would consider something toward the end of the year. Now, maybe they're doing that to make their budget figures look better. Mm. I predict, I would love to have a wager with you, Cassandra. Mm. Well, I don't suppose you'd want to bet that they won't do anything. I bet that they will. The question is the size that JobKeeper at... let's call it Newstart, at $40 a day will increase substantially.
Yeah, and Peter, I mean, every time the Treasurer's been asked or the Minister responsible's been asked, they say they're leaning in, they're, you know, look to December, they're just sort of delaying a decision. And my question is, why are we delaying it? You know, because the people tonight really need to know, you know, what their Christmas is going to look like and whether they can afford to stay in the rental property they're in right now or whether they're going to have to move themselves and their children. I mean, these are really big life decisions people are facing.
They are getting a Christmas present. They're getting people on pension and other welfare benefits are getting $250 to spend in December for Christmas.
Yes, but not people on JobSeeker.
It doesn't address this New Start issue, and this is a key structural thing, isn't it, Peter? I mean, Simon, to you, and we haven't heard from you on this. What's going on here? So the government seems to have squibbed a basic decision that at some point it needs to make, and this was the time to make it, wasn't it?
Well, I think they've missed an opportunity more broadly here, which is, and it's partly because of the extreme focus in this budget on short-term measures. And they haven't really looked at any of the more longer-term structural reform. And I mean, it sounds like that's an odd thing to look at during the midst of an emergency. But if you were going to spend $500 billion of deficit spending in these budgets, it would make sense to a certain extent to focus perhaps on some of the medium to longer-term problems that they could have fixed. Now, one of the things they could have done is they could have, for example, redesigned Newstart so that it was more generous to people who were on the payment for a longer period of time and structure it similar to the way that a number of payments in Europe are structured, for example, whereas people who are cycling off Newstart in a short period of time are given a smaller payment but fewer mutual obligation requirements, and people who are on the payment for a longer time who probably need additional assistance in securing employment get additional payments but also additional obligations and additional training and support. Now, that's the kind of thing that in a budget with a $200 billion deficit you could have done. The government hasn't done those sort of measures. What they've really done, and there's a fantastic chart in Budget Paper 4 that shows that the structural budget balance, the structural deficits, aren't really that different from what they've been for the last decade or what they're expected to be for the next decade. Where all the additional things are coming is these discretionary measures over the course of the next 2 or 3 years, and they account for something like $300 to $400 billion worth of deficits. And it isn't I think, a missed opportunity to do some more medium-term reform.
Mm. Okay, can we talk about this one of the budget's biggest items, which is this instant asset write-off for businesses? I mean, I don't know how many utes, photocopiers, pieces of plant, equipment, tractors, whatever they are in inventories around the country, but I hope they're healthy because the Treasurer says it's a game changer, will create tens of thousands of jobs. Peter, is this going to work? I mean, this depends majorly on a business thinking, I think the economy is going to be okay, I better go out and buy some new gear. Now, many businesses right now might be thinking, that's exactly the reverse of how I feel.
Yeah, and indeed, that they expect, with this payment, a fall of 14% in non-mining business investment.
Mm.
But nonetheless, they expect it to be taken up. So obviously the fall would have been bigger without it. It's the biggest single spending. Now, by spending, I also include tax cuts. You can think of, but for ease of language, I'll call it spending. The biggest single spending measure, $26.7 billion, twice what they're spending on tax cuts that 11 million Australian workers will get. So these are very substantial. If you were believing that you would survive and that they last till the middle of 22, so you've got 2 years to spend, if you believe that you'd still have a business in 2 years, it would make an awful lot of sense to get the utes to do things like that. But this is the problem with businesses, or the reality with businesses. Most businesses are small in terms of numbers. Most businesses die within the first year or so. So, and given that you're likely to be one of those businesses that won't survive, now there'll be other businesses, other restaurants or whatever, that will replace you, you would quite sensibly be reticent about spending on equipment, even if the tax office was going to pay half of it immediately.
Yeah. Mm. And given all the uncertainty, we've all got that agreement, right, that we really don't have a sense of where borders will be, where the pandemic will be. Who's best placed to carry the risk overall here? Mm. And our view was very clearly it should be on the government books, actually, with government-led investment, where, of course, the private sector can participate with confidence.
Mm.
And that's the kind of design of programs that we were pushing for, rather than leaving it all to small business to take their own risks when, you know, it will be really hard. And we don't want to see small business people accumulating more and more debt trying to, you know, charge a business when they are the only ones carrying the risk of all of that.
Yeah, so, I mean, also, I don't know, you wonder whether this kind of asset write-off program is of use to many industries which have been decimated, like service industries, like the travel industry, for example, which are really highly reliant on demand, on people moving and being able, and probably less reliant on, you know, their investment in plant and assets. You know, you wonder how much use this sort of assistance is going to be to them anyway.
That's certainly true, although one aspect of this that perhaps is unappreciated is that these sort of allowances will allow businesses to retool or refocus or shift from particular industries, or investment at least, to shift from particular industries. So it will at least facilitate some of the shift away from, you know, the tourism export-focused industries towards the government hopes manufacturing, although, to be honest, we've seen a lot of those initiatives before.
we've heard this. Come on, Simon. We've heard this a million times before. And the basic reasons why Australians don't manufacture anymore are still structurally there, aren't they?
They sure are. And yep. I remember when I was working in the industry department for the New South Wales government, a lot of those similar initiatives were being talked about more than a decade
exactly.
ago.
So, it's not enough to wish it will happen.
Absolutely. But at the end of the day, I think one thing the government has got right here is that it's going to have to eventually figure out a way to get private industry moving forward should they wish the economy to go again. Whatever the government can do in terms of spending and trying to boost or sustain demand, and you know, JobKeeper is a fantastic example of this, the government can at best attempt to hold things in stasis with enormous amounts of taxpayers' money. If it wants the economy to recover from the shock that it suffered, if we want businesses to start growing and employing again, and the vast majority of people work in the private sector, the only real option they have is to try and encourage businesses to invest and to employ people again. If government just keeps trying to spend money to try and keep things where they are, and you know, there's an enormous number of people who were on JobKeeper who don't have real jobs anymore, who are just functionally being paid an unemployment benefit to pretend they have a job. The government has to do something about that, and this budget, I think, is the first step towards fixing that problem of zombie companies and zombie jobs.
Sure. Can we talk about tax cuts? Donna in Canberra's texted me saying, Phil, I'm in a household with an income in excess of $120,000. We do not need a tax cut at this time. There are others with a greater need. Peter, what are the tax cuts? They've been fast-tracked. Can you just briefly outline them for us?
Oh, look, they're bloody attractive, by the way, and not, as has been feared, overly directed towards high earners, very high earners. Now, the next lot of tax cuts are, so the tax cuts which have been brought forward are those that were due in 2022. They've been brought forward 2 years to the... they've been, if you like, made a bit retrospective. They've been brought forward to the beginning of July this year. The ones that are really outrageously and unreasonably generous to high earners are the ones which were due in 2024. They haven't been brought forward. And those are real doozies. So that they give up to $200,000, you're on a 30% tax rate. They're quite something. But this lot isn't. So the change is your tax-free threshold remains up to $18,000 or so. Don't pay tax. Beyond that, you pay a 19% rate. At the moment, up to $37,000. That will, or already has, given that it's retrospective, change to $45,000. So that's a very substantial income that you'll only pay at most 19 cents in the dollar on each extra dollar earned. Beyond that, you'll be on a 32.5% rate, not up to 90,000 as it is at the moment, but all the way up to a lot more than that.
120.
Which is very, very, very attractive for... you know, almost everyone in every conceivable income group. Now, as well as that, they're giving, it's called a low income tax offset, and there's also a middle income tax offset. But in simple terms, what it is they're throwing you between $200 and $1,000 at the end of the year to top up your tax refund. So, This is quite substantial support. As I said, it's only half as much as what they're giving to business, but it's quite substantial support, and it is totally up to us whether we spend it or save it. Now, had they brought forward, as was imagined, the really extreme tax cuts for the top end, I think you could have made a very good argument that the people on $200,000 are probably not likely to increase their spending. In this case, it's up to us. Now, whether we do or we don't will depend on what we feel about our job prospects, what's happening about us. And it's really the same as the argument for business. We're being led to water, right? We're being given the opportunity.
There is one additional point here, though, that is that money, even if families don't spend it, that money will still be in their pockets and they'll still benefit from it. And longer term, in the medium to long term, even money that is saved by households functionally ends up as some form of investment going forward. So, you know, the businesses that don't take up investment...
My point about why we are opposed to these tax cuts is... whatever governments had planned a year ago, 2 years ago, aspirations, etc., we are where we are now as a country. It is different. what we are dealing with right now to where we were. And there was a discipline that we needed to bring into this budget to really know that the dollars that were to be spent, whether through tax expenditures or by direct transfer payments, would get the best value, you know, because we all know, Simon, you know, whether it's you or me or others into the future, we'll be sitting in interviews again, when people are talking about trying to get the budget back to balance, who pays the price? It's people on low incomes and social services that get cut away. And so it really matters what we spend at the moment.
Can I just raise the case for a number of years.
But Simon,
the budget's been moving back to balance through bracket creep.
Sure. Simon, can I raise a point, though, that the government must have learned by now, which is this assumption that if you give people a tax cut, they go and spend money. There's not a lot of evidence in recent years that that happens, is there? Because people
but
in
if
this
you give it to people
time,
are able, in
uncertain times tend to either
that's
pay
right.
down their mortgage.
But if you're living in poverty, you'll spend it.
Of course. But leaving that to one side, this idea that a tax cut necessarily means more money's flowing around in the economy, I mean, how credible is that idea in these uncertain times when people are thinking, the last thing I want to be doing right now is spending any more money?
Well, that's a fair question. And there's interestingly some recent research that my colleague's been working on that sort of suggests that the difference in the multiplier impact of tax cuts and spending actually perhaps isn't as high as we think. But one of the things that I think is actually coming here is that I don't think the government believes they need as much immediate stimulus as perhaps they originally thought they may have needed, and that what they're seeking to do here is to provide some, I mean, even if not economic benefit, then political benefit of providing assistance to particularly that bracket of people at the sort of $40,000 to $120,000 a year income, you know, the bulk of swinging voters, providing them with something tangible that they can say, you know, the government gave you JobKeeper during the COVID crisis. We're now giving you tax cuts. We're putting this money back in your pocket. It's $1,000 or $2,000 a year. It's nearly $5,000 a family. There's a political benefit to providing the assistance in this form rather than providing it through other types of spending, particularly some of the types of spending that perhaps doesn't provide as big a political benefit for a coalition government as that might have provided for a Labor government.
Mm. Yep, okay. Discussion about the position of women and the pandemic, Cassandra, has been the subject of quite a bit of comment. I mean, women, I think it's fair to say, have borne the brunt of the pandemic in terms of job losses and elsewhere.
Yeah,
economically, yes.
Simon, actually, can I just kick off by saying, can you as a man not speak over me when the question's been put to me as a woman, just in that on that particular question?
Cassandra.
Thanks, Simon. I think that question was directed at me first. Thank you, Simon. You'll get your turn in a moment. Can I just highlight that, of course, there has been a variable impact in terms of jobs. There's no question that women have been, you know, very badly affected, and there's been some change to the dynamics in the economy over the last period about that. But of course, it's not just about the job losses. It's about the caring responsibilities and the homeschooling that's gone on, and of course, the big debates about what we do with childcare there. And in the country like Australia, we still have a very skewed approach to who picks up the bulk of those family and caring responsibilities. That's the reality of it. And as we know, I've highlighted earlier that relying so heavily on many frontline caring services to be at the front line of the pandemic, of the economic distress in the community. And so this is kind of very feminised workforces. And so what we don't have in the budget tonight is any big investment in those kinds of areas where we're going to have people really burning out badly. Mm. I mean, I've got very distressed colleagues speaking to me about what they're seeing in their workforces, where very, you know, feminised workforces who are on the front line trying to keep it all all the balls in the air, and we're not seeing any more injection of significant funding into those sorts of areas. And so I think this is a very real part of what, you know, what's going on. I don't think there is anything anywhere near enough in terms of childcare. Gee, if, you know, in terms of, we speak about reform, we had a moment there where we really could have taken a great leap forward in Australia and fixed childcare.
It's not a reform budget, is it?
It matters to everybody, doesn't it, to get childcare right?
It's not a reform budget. It's a stimulus budget. There's no question about that. Yeah. My panel tonight is Cassandra Goldie, who you just heard speaking, CEO of the Australian Council of Social Service, Simon Cowan, Research Director at the Centre for Independent Studies, and Peter Mutton, Economy Editor at The Conversation. We've discussed a lot on the program the question of infrastructure and infrastructure spending, and this is seen as a way to stimulate the economy, and people think money doesn't cost anything to borrow at the moment. Governments have got great capacity to borrow, so this is our golden chance to be developing major infrastructure projects. The government has announced a few in the budget. How much of this is new money, Peter Mutton?
Not all of it is new money, and the really big money is not spent on infrastructure. The really big money is spent, as, by the way, is consistent with what the government talks about, a private sector led recovery, is spent on investment tax breaks for businesses. To the extent that there is spending on infrastructure, and this is notoriously double and multiple counted, sort of re-announced every year, it's the employment...
In the way that infrastructure projects are.
Oh, yeah.
Always announced at least 14 times before they're actually built.
The extent to which...
Roads and bridges, yes.
The extent to which that does happen, roads and bridges don't employ the kind of people who have lost their jobs.
No.
So the kind of people who have lost their jobs are people who make coffee, people who work in
tourism,
travel industry, yeah, universities. And with all due respect to these people, they're not good at laying railway sleepers.
No.
And they're more likely to be women. And the kind of people who are good at laying pipelines and railway sleepers are the kind of people who are more likely to be men, and they're not the people who have predominantly, in this recession, not the people who have predominantly lost their jobs. Now, once upon a time, up until the Abbott budget, the first Abbott budget in 2004, the government issued with each budget a gender impact statement, or sometimes it's called the women's budget statement. And what it did was to examine each budget, each measure through a gender lens, right? Now, the importance of this wasn't only the publication, it was that each department had in it, from the days of Bob Hawke, someone whose job it was to assess the measures before they happened, and I suppose to change them, because people knew that this statement would be published, so that the impact was not unbalanced on men and women. We lost that with the Abbott budget. We lost something else, which was a statement of different family types, you know, dual income, no kids, and so on. That's gone. We haven't had that for 6 years. That also vanished in the first Abbott budget. And so as a result, not only are we a bit blind to the effects of the budget. Now, we'll find out in subsequent weeks. Universities will do their analysis and so on. But the makers of the budget are themselves blind.
Mm.
Now, deliberately so in the first Abbott budget, because they were skewed to hurting low-income people, those measures were. But ever since then, on these sort of measures, because the government hasn't published them, we're a bit
blind. We don't
know
what's happening. Simon, what do you make of these infrastructure announcements?
Well, so there's a number of different issues with infrastructure spending. First, if you're undertaking infrastructure spending for the purpose of stimulus, it's a pretty bad way of doing that. There are very long lead times for infrastructure projects. There's, fairly limited benefit that tends to accrue to particular industries. Those industries aren't necessarily struggling at the moment. You've got basically the opposite of what you would be looking for if you're looking for stimulus payments. The issue with infrastructure, and particularly the case that people are sort of saying, oh, money's cheap, you should just spend now, infrastructure needs to make a return. It needs to ideally make a positive return, but at least it needs to make some kind of return. And that requirement doesn't disappear because debt is cheap. Hmm. And what we see over and over and over again from both sides of politics at federal and state level, infrastructure spending priorities are determined by political benefits, not economic benefits. So it would be fantastic if the government said, we're going to spend $100 billion to invest in infrastructure that will boost productivity by this amount. We can demonstrate that in these areas. Here are the priorities. But that's not what happens. We get a series of announcements. This marginal electorate needs a new road.
So rather than following the dictates of Infrastructure Australia and using their ranking system, we simply build pet projects in electorates where we think we can get maximum political advantage.
Absolutely.
Gee, who would have thought of an idea like that, Simon?
I think there's a program that's been built off the back of that.
Both sides of politics do it. It's why, for example, the first place to get hooked up with the NBN was Tasmania and Armidale.
Mm.
Yeah. I mean, look, you know, in terms of the kinds of jobs that, you know, we should have been stimulating in order to respond to where jobs have been lost and, you know, therefore people who have particular skills. We again, you know, focus, for example, on energy efficiency. Now, that would have been a big injection into all over the country in regions, you know, so that ability to unbundle billions and spend it all over the country, small scale, both doing maintenance work on community housing, on private rental, helping bang for your buck. One of the best things you can do to reduce energy bills for people on lower incomes is to properly get energy efficiency measures into those homes. We had huge support across all of the sectors for that. There would have been a bundle of, you know, for low skill or at least jobs that were you could relatively quickly train up to be involved in them.
The government might be frightened by the thought of pink bats.
But we worked very hard to fix that, and the problem of energy bill prices for people and the problem of emissions has not gone away, and so, you know, we have to be prepared to go there because we've got very low energy efficiency standards. And you know, the government likes to say it cares about energy bills, and what are we doing? We're doing gas.
Sure. Can I ask you about Cassandra about aged care? These are issues which have been raised particularly in the pandemic. We've seen, by any account, deficiencies in the supply of aged care, which is a federal government responsibility. Now, Josh Frydenberg's announced a 23,000 more aged care home packages, but there didn't seem to be a lot of addressing of the awful statistic that tens of thousands of Australians die while waiting for their aged care package. It's all very well to announce these things, but, actually delivering some of these projects, and this is a problem generally with the government, is it that they're good on announcing things, delivering things is another matter. Yeah. And the aged care packages is an issue, isn't it? Do you see a way forward in this budget that Australians are going to get these things quicker?
Well, we've got to work harder at it. So there is some dollars in this budget for support. Sort of workforce development in the aged care sector. So this thing of transitioning people from other jobs that have been lost into the aged care sector is really important. And the 23,000 additional home care packages, again, it doesn't meet the backlog of over 100,000. But, you know, it's certainly, we've got to keep adding to that. I mean, what the Royal Commission is going to recommend very clearly is uncapping. So this notion that we've only got so many home care packages. So, oops, if you didn't get one, you know, you just going to have to
if
wait.
If I opened the lines on this right now, people would say to me, when I ring and ask when I'm going to get an assessment, the answer will be, we do not know.
Exactly.
We do not
exactly.
know.
Exactly. How did we get there? Well, we got there because we didn't invest enough in these caring services, again, highly feminised. And this is the time for us to call it out and repeatedly do it until it's fixed. And, we can't wait for another Royal Commission. Whether it's going to be in mental health or in other areas. We've underspent in these critical human service areas for a long time. We've relied heavily on privatising as if somehow that was miraculously going to deliver a better outcome. Well, clearly it has not. And regulation and meeting standards and taking this very seriously as governments is at the heart of this.
Simon, can you explain to me what the announcement about water funding was, which I understand was $2 billion over 10 years improving water infrastructure, which sounds, pardon the pun, like a drop in the ocean if you think about these issues. What was going on there?
One, one of the old political heroes of my side and particularly my organisation was a chap called Bert Kelly. And what he always used to say
I know him well, yes.
You know, when you could always feel an election coming on when governments start announcing more money for dams.
That's right.
And my sense of what's happening here is precisely that. You know, it's an attempt to... And I saw a suggestion, and I must confess I can't confirm, I haven't dug deep down enough for this, but this has actually redirected money from a previous dam building fund which hadn't been actually used at any point in time. So, you know, I think what we're seeing here is a way to try and push money out for infrastructure projects in the regions. Dam building is one of those really popular things because it's such a, you know, clear and demonstrable project that you can point to. Mm. But the benefits of a lot of this stuff, you know, we saw with the sort of suggestions around creating water infrastructure in the Northern Territory and sort of northwest Western Australia and the constant plan to turn that into a food bowl. You know, some of those plans are just horribly uneconomic and they don't become economic because we're in a pandemic.
Sure. Peter, can we just finish up because we don't have that long to go. Just quickly, there's been a lot of discussion about whether or not we need to care so much about debt as we used to. Once upon a time, governments, we're conditioned by the governments telling us that debt is terrible. But of course, around the world these days, there are huge levels of debt. The world doesn't seem to have collapsed. And a lot of experts would say that Australia's debt is quite manageable, actually. What's your view?
Oh, well, there's an equation as to whether it's manageable. It's very straightforward. If the economy, government income grows with the economy, if the economy grows by more than the interest rate on the debt, you're laughing. It's going to fall, or your servicing costs are going to fall as a proportion of GDP. And this is what happened after the war. We've run budget deficits. Debt has been increasing in absolute terms, but it's been falling in as a proportion of the economy as the economy's been growing. The government, quite rightly, thinks that its highest priority is economic growth, that if people get jobs, then the government will get income, the debt won't be a big issue. It's correct to think that, but I think it's gone about it the wrong way. I agree with Cassandra. I think that we had an opportunity to get something lasting out of this, be it social housing, be it a dam that was actually worthwhile, be it going back and doing the NBN properly. Yeah. I don't know. We had an opportunity to get something out of this.
It's not a big picture budget, is it?
Disaster resilience would have been great.
What do you think about that, Simon? Do you think it was an opportunity for a big, you know, for a big reform option here? Because there really isn't one, is there?
Well, I think the government had an opportunity to set a medium to long-term agenda that would have been very difficult for a new government to overturn because whatever happens after the next two budgets, it's going to be focused on trying to bring down the deficit and ultimately manage the debt. So they could have done things in the next two budgets that would have been very, very difficult to unwind, and they really haven't taken those steps. I think in a just pure political terms, though, the government seems to believe that the only people who care about debt and deficit vote for them anyway and will continue to vote for them more or less no matter what they do. And I suspect, just in crude political terms, they're probably right.
Hmm. Might we hear, Cassandra, an end to this rather arid debate that's gone on about debts being bad and deficits being bad and only one side of politics is to be trusted on this matter. Given that both sides of politics have now have been faced with, you know, the GFC in Labor's case and the pandemic here in the Coalition's case, have been faced with the situations where you have to spend.
Yeah. Well, look, you know, as somebody who has been involved in advocating to support people on low incomes and to have a good approach to a healthy community, it has been one of the most bereft debates we've had. We have always understood at ACOS, for example, that having a sensible, really disciplined approach to budget measures is really important, no question. Mm. And in past, you know, budget proposals, we've recommended where you would pull back spending. But it was always so that you could invest where you really needed it. And again tonight, we've got now a bigger deficit. We've got a lot bigger debt. Have we going to get the value out of it? Well, that's not what we see tonight. And I think that's the great shame of it because, you know, government is the right one to manage the overall risk of what we're dealing with. We are very fortunate. We've got a low interest environment at the moment. And we wanted to see government as a lead partner in setting this direction because that also would have really helped with confidence on the private sector front, that they could also see that government was going to be with them for the long haul, and we don't really have a big picture on that at the moment.
It does make you wish in some ways for the simplicity of the old days, doesn't it, Peter, with beer and cigs up, and that was the major problem that most people had to face these days.
You wish for Peter Costello to come back and work his magic, surely.
Oh, I'm looking forward to a female treasurer, actually.
We're going to have a new finance minister. Matthias has bowed out after a record number of budgets as finance minister.
That is true. He has indeed.
Well, can I say one good thing about...
Very briefly.
And it's this. The government has shown itself to be willing to adapt to circumstances. And if things turn down, if business doesn't rise to the challenge, the government will do something else. So I think the days of us waiting for a budget are gone. There'll be an economic statement, call it whatever you want, as is needed to get the economy back, because the government, and we all really want that, and the government has shown itself to be
a bit
very
like,
attuned to the
a bit like the news
that.
Cycle. We're on a 24/7 cycle.
And we've got
MAIFO
to go very shortly, so hopefully we'll see that permanent increase to JobSeeker pretty soon.
All right, well, do you want to bet? By the end of the year. All right, we better say goodbye. Cassandra Goldie, CEO of the Australian Council of Social Service. Thank you, Cassandra.
Thanks.
Simon Cowan from the CIS Research Director there. Thanks, Simon.
Thanks,
and Peter Martin from The Conversation as
Thanks.
Well. Thank you, Peter.
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife. You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife. Yeah.